Chicago is a mortal town, I said, and mortal justice is going to be served.
Oh, my God, Tanya said, rolling her eyes.
Did you really just say that out loud? You sound like a comic book. Comic book, I said. Let's see. Do I go for Hulk smash or it's clobbering time? Tanya tensed, though she tried to hide it, and her voice came out in a rush. Bit of a coincidence, don't you think, that Chicago's only professional wizard wound up on that jury? I tilted my head and frowned. She was right. In fact, the more I thought about it, the more this felt like a turf war. Oh, I get it. Luther was one of Marcone's soldiers. So loyal he went to prison for 10 years rather than inform on Marcone, Tanya confirmed. Or maybe just smart enough to know what would happen to him if he did. He went straight after he got out, but... When he got in trouble, Marcone stood up for one of his own, I said. He pulled strings to get me on the jury. Luther was getting nailed to a wall, Tanya said. Marcone controls crime, but Lara has a lot to say over the law these days. I suppose he thought someone like you might be the only chance Luther had. Gutsy of him to try to make a cat's paw of Harry Dresden. I hear you don't like that. Damn it. Marcone had put me where there'd been a guy getting fast-tracked to an unjust sentence, and known damn well how I would react. He could have asked me for help, but I'd have told him to take a flying leap, and he'd have known that. So he set it up without me knowing. Or hell. He and Mab had been in cahoots lately. Maybe he'd asked her to arrange it. This had her fingerprints all over it. Tanya, I said, it's hard for me to tell with vampires, but I'm guessing you're pretty new to this work. She winked at me. Let's just say that I'm old enough to know better and young enough not to care. She picked up a drink from the table. This one is over, Dresden. You can't do anything here. You can't even produce evidence in the trial, not as a juror. You can't get to Luther to tell him you found the little girl. And even if you could, you aren't taking her away from us. Not until it's too late. The girl is the only evidence that Black wasn't a poor victim, and I have her. This one is done. Marcone lost the round. I win. She winked at me. What does Marcone mean to you? You don't owe him anything. Why not sit down, have a drink, help me celebrate? I stared at Tanya for a minute. No, I said quietly. You just don't get it. This isn't about Lara and Marcone anymore. It's not even really about Luther. Then I looked at the little girl. Honey, I asked, making sure my voice was a lot gentler, do you want to go home? She looked at me. She was cute enough for a kid her age, with caramel skin and big green eyes. She nodded, very hesitantly, flinching, as if she thought Tanya might hit her. Okay, I said. Tanya was staring at me as though she couldn't quite grasp what was happening. But her voice was harder when she said, Gentlemen, the wizard doesn't like carrots. It's time for the stick. To my right, from behind the bar, another 4 men rose. They were holding short-barreled shotguns. To my left, from the bathrooms, another 4 thugs appeared, clutching various long guns. I'll count to 3, Tanya said. Boys, when I get to 3, kill him. Crap. They were flanking me. My shield was excellent, but it was not omnidirectional. No matter which way I turned it, one or more groups of thugs would have a shot at my unprotected back. 1, Tanya said, smiling. 2? Comic book, huh? I said. Have it your way. 3, she chirped. Guns swiveled to me. 12 men took aim. Hexus! I snarled, unleashing a wave of disruptive energy. And every light in the place blew out in a shower of sparks, plunging the club into darkness. Guns started going off, but only from the most confident or stupid gunman, so I wasn't cut to ribbons. I was already moving. Hitting a moving target isn't easy, not even when it's fairly close. Hitting one in the dark is even harder. Hitting one moving in sporadic flashes of light is harder yet. I got lucky, or none of them did, however you want to think of it, and I got to the thugs beside Tanya in one piece. One of them got off a shot at the sound, but I caught the round on my shield, and the resulting shower of sparks showed the men on my flanks that I was among their compatriots, and no one shot at my back.
I knew Lara hired almost exclusively from former military.
Mostly Marines. Men like that don't shoot their buddies. I dropped the shield and threw a punch at the guy in front of me. Ever since I started working for the Queen of Air and Darkness, I had been stronger than the average wizard, or the average champion weightlifter, for that matter, and I knew how to throw a punch. I connected with a man's jaw hard and shouted, BAM! As I did. The thug reeled back, his legs going wobbly and useless as he ragdolled to the floor. I threw a stomping kick toward the belly of the guy next to him, shouting, POW! I hit him in the dark, somewhere more or less near his belly. His gun went off randomly as he was lifted off the floor and thrown 10 feet back into a wall. He was trying to scream breathlessly. I winced. I hadn't meant to hit him there, but those were the breaks. I raised my shield again and dropped, just as the bad guys with shotguns realized that I didn't have any of their buddies standing near me. I trusted the shield and turned my face away from the blinding shower of green-gold sparks it sent flying up as buckshot hammered into it. The copper band got hot on my wrist, even as I flung my right hand out toward the group of goons by the bathroom and shouted, Forsari! Raw, telekinetic force hit three of them. One was the guy from the street, who again impressed me with his smarts by diving to one side out of the wave of energy. As shotguns pounded my shield, he slid to a stop, with an automatic braced in both hands, took a breath, and aimed carefully, only moving his finger to the trigger after he had his sights lined up on me. Crap! To steal from Bruce, no matter how turbocharged the wizard, someone with brains, guts, and a 45 can seriously cramp his style. Fortunately, I wasn't in this fight alone. I'd been counting on Will to join in at the right moment, and he didn't let me down. 200 pounds of gray-brown Timberwolf, wearing a service dog cape, hit the smart gunman at full sprint, bowling him over. A flash of white fangs sent the gun flying. Total elapsed time since I'd killed the lights, maybe 3.5 seconds. Will threw himself into the guys I'd knocked around by the bathrooms, and I turned to discover that I'd been right about Tanya. She was new to this game. She'd been sitting there with a stunned look on her face at the abruptness of the violence. I flung myself into the booth with her, getting as close as I could, wrapping my left arm around her neck hard enough to pull her head in against my body and still have my shield ready to stop more gunfire. But the smart gunman screamed, "Check fire! Check fire!" the second I did. The shooting stopped. There was an abrupt silence in the club, which was filled with the sharp scent of gunpowder. For a second, I felt a cool, sweet sensation flooding into me. I realized that Tanya had slipped a hand beneath my shirt and was running her fingertips over my stomach. If anyone ever tells you that being fed on by a vampire of the White Court is not a big deal, they're lying. It's ecstasy, and heroin, and sex, and chocolate all rolled into one, and that's just the foreplay. So I stopped her by tightening my grip on her until it threatened to break her neck. Tanya let out a little yelp and whipped her hand away from my skin. I met the white eyes of the little girl and said, "Hold on, honey. I'm going to take you home in just a second."
"You can't," Tanya said.
I scowled and flicked her skull with the forefinger of my free hand in annoyance.
"Wow, you're new to this," I said, panting.
5 seconds of combat is enough cardio to last a while.
"How old are you, kid?"
"I'm 20," she said, her teeth clenched with discomfort, "and I am not a child."
20, I said. "No wonder Lara sent a babysitter along with you."
Just then, the room flooded with green chemical light. I eyed the smart gunman, who had just fired up a chemical glow stick from a pocket. I nodded at him, holding it a moment, and said, "I'm Dresden." He pushed himself up from the floor with his left arm, holding his right in close to his side.
It bore long lacerations, and the blood looked black in the green light. He nodded back to me and said warily, "Riley." I twisted my upper body just enough to drag Tanya around a little. She let out a squeaking sound. "Can you see the score here, Riley?" He studied the room, wincing, and said, "Yeah. How do you want to play it?" "Guns down," I said. "Me, the wolf, the girl, and Miss Wraith here will walk out. No one comes after us. Once we're on the street, I'll let her go." He stared at me, and I could see the wheels turning. I didn't like that. The guy had been too capable to give him time to work something out. "You boys just gave me a 21-gun salute, and the front door to the club was broken open, Riley," I said. "Police response time around here is about 4 minutes. How long you think it'll take someone to call it in?" Riley grimaced. "Give me your word." "You have it," I said. "Okay," he said. He looked around the room and said, "Stand down. We're gonna let them leave." "Damn you, Riley!" Tanya snarled. I pressed the still uncomfortably hot copper bracelet against her ear, and she yipped. "Come on, Miss Wraith," I said. I stood up, keeping her head locked in my arm.
She could have made a fight out of it.
White Court vampires can be unbelievably strong, if only in bursts. She didn't seem up for a physical fight, but I wasn't taking chances. I moved carefully and kept my balance, ready to move instantly if she tried anything. "Come on, honey," I said to the little girl. I extended my free hand to her. "I'm going to take you home." She stood up and reluctantly took my hand. Will padded out of the shadows to walk on the other side of the girl, his teeth bared. On a wolf, that is an absolutely terrifying expression. As I went by Riley, I asked,
"Lara giving Tanya here a lesson?"
"Something like that," he said. "You hurt her, things will have to get ugly." "I get it," I said. "You'd have had me if I hadn't cheated." "You aren't cheating. You aren't trying hard enough," he replied. "Another time, maybe." "I hope not," I told him, sincerely. And I walked out with a vampire in a headlock, and a little girl overlapped in the protective shadows of a wizard and a werewolf,
while Lara Wraith's soldiers looked on.
"Your Honor," the foreman of the jury said to the judge. She paused to turn to me and give me a deadly glare. "After 2 days of deliberation, the jury has been unable to reach a unanimous verdict in the case." Luther, lonely at his table, blinked and sat up straighter, his eyes opening wider. The assistant DA made an almost identical expression. Beside him, Tanya sat staring stonily forward, with her hair combed over her singed ear. The judge eyed the jury box with weary resignation, and her gaze settled on me. "What?" I said, and folded my arms. "I believed him." She rubbed at her eyes with one hand and said something beneath her breath. I listened closely, which is much closer than most people can, and thought I heard her mutter, "Goddamn supernatural assholes." She lifted her eyes again and spoke in that rote repetition voice. "That being the case, I have no choice but to declare a mistrial. Mr. Tremont, the prosecution's office will need to notify me about whether the people mean to continue pursuing this case against the defendant." I eyed Tanya, smiling. If the White Court tried to push this trial again, I could produce the girl, Maria, as a witness. Maria was currently being watched by a number of werewolves and wasn't going to go anywhere. If they continued pushing Luther, I could drag their ugliness out into the light. And if there was anything the White Court hated, it was looking ugly. Tanya gave me a sulking glance. Then she muttered something to Tremont, who blinked at her. They had a brief, heated discussion, conducted entirely in whispers. Then Tremont looked back up at them. Your Honor, the state would like to drop all charges.
It would?
The judge asked. Then she rolled her eyes and said, Oh, of course it would. All right, people. Justice is served. Court is adjourned. She banged her gavel down half-heartedly and rose.
We all stood up as she left the courtroom, and then we began filing out.
Luther sat there dazed as the bailiff approached and removed his handcuffs. Then he was buried by a pair of quietly squealing children who piled onto him and were shortly joined by a woman with tears in her eyes. I heard him start laughing as he hugged them. I left because there was something in my eyes. Outside in the parking lot, someone approached me and I felt a tug at my sleeve. It took me a second to recognize the judge in her civilian clothes, a plain pair of slacks and a white shirt. "Let me guess," she said, "someone found the girl." "The girl from what's-his-name's testimony?" I asked guilelessly. And if the girl had gotten up in front of everyone and answered questions, it would have made things awkward for whoever was behind Black. Am I right? I scratched at my nose with one finger and said, "Maybe." She snorted and turned to walk away. "Worst jurist ever." "Thanks," I said. She stopped and looked at me over her shoulder with a faint smile. "You're welcome." I hung around long enough to see Luther, a free man, leaving the building with his family. Maybe Will had been right. Justice served.
Day 1. Waldo Butters was never supposed to amount to much. No, seriously, he was a throwaway character. I had a particularly gruesome morgue scene that I wanted to leaven with a little humor, so I more or less swiped the medical examiner from the movie The Prophecy, dyed his hair black and curly, made him a Jewish polka-file, and had him start spreading levity. A while later, I was writing a story that was going to have a pretty good dramatic high point and was going to be filled with necromancers. I wanted it to be a particularly tough ride for Dresden, so I looked around for the perfect sidekick for this story. Someone who would be thematically appropriate, yet able to do almost nothing to actually help Dresden in a fight. I had necromancers and animated corpses, and I had this goofy but highly intelligent medical examiner who had already been planted into the series. As a bonus, Waldo Butters was a newbie to the world of the supernatural, but was bright and could be counted on to ask smart questions. And since this book was going to be my first hardback, it was also going to be the Dresden Files' introduction to a slew of new readers, and Butters' questions would make it easy for them to get into the structure of the story world. Kind of made it a no-brainer that Butters needed to be the guy. But, my brain said, as it does endlessly, that's not quite enough, is it? And so I looked at Butters and started making plans. At the end of the day, the greatest power Harry has is in lifting up the people around him. As he has gone through his story, the people he trusts and has befriended have themselves grown in knowledge and in power. He's never really meant to do it, but this little community of people with brains, backbones, and good hearts has developed around him, and Butters is one of the foremost members of that community. The little guy has grown a lot over the course of this story. He was entirely unexpected, and I just couldn't be more pleased with how his story is going. Here's a small but important piece of Butters' tale. His first day on the job as a knight.
"My name is Waldo Butters, and I am a Jedi Knight, like my father before me. Okay, so that isn't exactly technically in a completely legal sense true. I mean, my dad was actually a podiatrist. But I'm as close to the real deal as anyone is likely to ever see in this world. I'm an actual knight, anyway. Or at least I was training to be one when, on a Thursday morning, I first heard the call. Only, I didn't hear it exactly, technically, in a completely legal sense. Look, maybe I should just tell the story. Of all the training Michael Carpenter had me doing, the cardio part was what I liked best. Then again, my main Pandora station plays only polka music, so what the heck do I know? I ran along through the early dawn light in Bucktown while the city began to wake up. The training belt around my waist tugged at my balance constantly and unpredictably. It was hooked to a bungee cord attaching me to Michael's bicycle, being pulled along behind me as I ran. Michael would swerve and brake randomly. Sometimes he'd hold the brake for several strides, and I'd have to shift to much more powerful strides to keep moving. It was demanding work. Constantly being forced to alter my balance meant that I could never fall into a nice, efficient rhythm, and I had to pay attention to every single step. The first several weeks, that had been a problem, but I was getting used to it now. Or rather, I was getting used to it until I saw something impossible, forgot to pay attention, got pulled off balance by my bungee cord, and crashed into a plastic recycling bin waiting by the side of the street. Michael immediately came to a stop, swinging his stiff leg out like an improvised kickstand. He was action hero-sized, moving toward his late 50s, and had his walking cane strapped to the backpack he wore.
"Waldo," he asked, "are you all right?"
I stumbled upright again, panting. I peered down the street. "I'm not really sure." Michael looked in the same direction I was, frowning. He pursed his lips thoughtfully. "You don't see that, do you?" I asked.
"See what?"
I squinted, took off my glasses, cleaned them on a corner of my shirt that wasn't covered in sweat, put them back on and checked again. It was still there. "If you could see it, you wouldn't have to ask that." He nodded seriously.
"Tell me what you see."
"That homeless guy on the bench?" I asked.
"Yes."
I took a breath and said, "There's a big yellow exclamation point floating over his head." After a brief pause, I added, "I'm not crazy. My mother had me tested." Michael sat back a little on the bike seat and rubbed at his beard pensively. He missed the reference.
Odd. Does that bring anything to mind for you personally?"
I snorted. "Yeah, it's what every NPC and every MMORPG ever looks like when they have a quest to give you."
"There were a great many letters in that, and not much that I understood," he said soberly.
"Video games," I clarified. "When a game character has a quest for you, that's how the game shows you where the quest begins. A big floaty exclamation point over their heads. You go talk to them, and that's how the quest starts." Michael barked out a laugh and gave the sky a small smile and a shake of his head.
"Well then, Sir Waldo, you've just had your first call."
"My what now?"
"Your first call to a quest, I suppose."
I blinked. "Uriel talks to the knights through video game symbolism?"
"As far as I know, Uriel talks in person. The call comes from higher up."
"What?" I asked. "You mean, like, God? God speaks video game?"
"When the Almighty speaks to men, he always does it in voices they can understand,"
Michael said.
"When I felt the call, it was always a still, small voice that would come to me when I was in prayer or otherwise quiet. Sometimes I'd have a very strong impression of a name or a face and a direction that I needed to go."
He nodded toward the transient.
"Apparently, you have been called to help that man."
"Put like that, it does seem to be fairly obvious." I swallowed. I know we've been training pretty hard, but am I really ready for this?" He reached into the backpack, withdrew an old leather messenger bag from it, and offered it to me.
"Let's find out."
I swallowed. Then I nodded and slung the bag over one shoulder. I reached into it and patted the old worn wooden handle inside, and then walked over to the sleeping man. He wore an army surplus field jacket, an old Desert Storm-style khaki BDUs, and he had a beard that birds could have nested in. There wasn't much gray in it, but his skin was weathered enough to make it difficult to guess his age. 40? By the time I got within 5 feet of him, I could see that something was wrong. There was a lot of vomit on the slatted bench by the man's head and the ground beneath. One of his eyes was half open, dilated, and his breath rasped in and out. "Hey," I said. "Hey, buddy. Can you hear me?" No response. I knelt down and took his wrist, feeling for his pulse. It was hard because it was thready and irregular. "Hey," I said gently. Hey, man. Can you hear me? He let out a little groan. I checked his other eye. The pupil was normal in that one. I didn't enjoy the work of being an actual physician, professionally. I liked examining corpses for the state of Illinois. Corpses never lie to you, never give you opaque answers, never ask stupid questions, or ignore what you tell them they need to do. Corpses are simple. And this guy, who wasn't nearly as old as I had thought when I walked up to him, was going to be one if he didn't get attention fast. Call 911, I said to Michael. I think he's had a stroke, maybe an overdose. Either way, he's lucky he slept on his side, or he'd have choked on his own vomit by now. He needs an ER. Michael nodded once, hobbled a few feet away, and produced a cell phone from a leather case on his belt. He called and began speaking quietly. Okay, buddy, I said to the guy. Hang in there. We're calling the good guys, and they're going to help you. I don't even know what happened. One second he was lying there, a wheezy vegetable, and the next he was coming at me hard, his ragged nailed hands grasping for my throat while he gurgled, "No hospital!" A few months ago, I'd have gotten strangled right there. But a few months ago, I hadn't been training in hand-to-hand with Michael's wife, Charity. It takes several thousand repetitions of a motion to develop motor memory pathways in the brain to the point where you can consider the motion a reflex. To that end, Charity, who was into jiu-jitsu, had made me practice several different defenses 100 times each, every day, for the past 2 months. She didn't practice by just going through a motion slowly and gradually speeding up, either. She just came at me like she meant to disassemble me, and if I didn't defend successfully, it freaking hurt. You learn fast in those circumstances. And one of the basic defenses she'd drilled into me had been against a simple front choke. Both of my forearms snapped up, knocking the grasping hands away, even as I ducked my head and rolled my body to one side. He kept coming through the space where I'd been. His arm hit my face and sent my glasses spinning off me. I fought down a decades-old panic as the world shifted from its usual shapes into sudden streaks and blurs of color. Look, I wear some big, thick glasses. I'm not quite legally blind without them. I know, because after I gave my optometrist a very expensive bottle of whiskey, he told me so. But without them, it's pretty tough to get anything done, or see anything more than an arm's length away. Seriously, I'd once mistaken a dressmaker's mannequin for my girlfriend. Reading was all but impossible without them. Reading. My great nightmare is to be stuck somewhere without them, trapped, peering at the sea of fuzzy things that couldn't possibly be identified. When I'd been a kid, the first thing the bullies did, always, was knock my glasses off. Always. It was like they'd all had a sixth sense or something. Then they would start having fun with me. That wasn't a delight either, but it was the not knowing what was coming that made it all worse. Inside, that kid started screaming and wailing, but there was no time to indulge him. I had a problem to solve, and the carpenters had given me the tools I needed to solve it. For instance, they taught me that once things are this close, you don't really get a lot done with your eyes when it comes to fighting. It was all speed and reflex and knowing where the enemy was and what he was doing by feel. I was sloppy, and it took me a second, but I managed to lock the bum's arm out straight. I kept it moving, got my body to twist at the right angle to put pressure on the shoulder joint, and brought him flat onto his face on the sidewalk with enough force to send stars flying into his vision and stun him. It didn't stun him much.
"No hospital!"
he screamed, thrashing. I fought to control the fear that was running through me. He was operating with more strength than he should have been. But it didn't matter. Physics is physics, and his arm was one long lever that I had control of. He might have been bigger and stronger than me, and the way we were positioned, that didn't matter in the least. He fought for a few more seconds, and then the burst of frenzy began to peter out.
No hospital. No hospital.
He shuddered and began to weep. His voice became a plea, rendered flat with despair.
No hospital. Please. Please. No hospital.
Then he went limp and made slow, regular rasping sounds. I eased off the pressure and gave him his arm back. It fell limply to the sidewalk as he cried. Buddy, I said, hey, it's going to be all right. I'm Waldo. What's your name?
Stan,
he said, in a hollow voice. Hey, Stan, I said, try not to worry. We're going to get you taken care of.
You're killing me, he said. You're killing me.
Your pulse is erratic, your breathing is impaired, and your eyes are showing different levels of dilation, Stan. What do you want?
Nothing,
he said.
You're killing me. Damn you.
In a few minutes, the ambulance arrived. A few seconds later, someone tapped the side of my chest with my glasses, and I put them back on. I looked up at an EMT, a blocky black guy named Lamar. I knew him. He was a solid guy. Thanks, man, I said.
You tackle this guy?
He asked.
Shoot, you ain't no bigger than a chicken dinner.
But spicy, I said. I gave him everything I had about Stan, and they got him checked, loaded up, and ready to head out to the ER in under 4 minutes. Hey, Lamar, I said, as he was rolling the gurney.
Yes, Examiner Mulder.
Scully was the M.E., I complained. How come no one calls me Examiner Scully?
"'Cause you ain't a thinking man's tart, Lamar drawled. What you need?
Where are you taking him?
St. Anthony's.
I nodded. Is there anything, odd happening over there lately?
No,
Lamar said, scratching his chin.
Not that I see, but it's only Tuesday.
Do me a favor, I said. Keep your eyes open.
Hell, Butters,
he said. Let me rephrase that, I said. Let me know if you see anything odd. It might be important. Lamar gave me a long look. I already had a reputation and history with supernatural weirdness, even before I met Harry Dresden and learned how scary the world really is. Lamar had gotten a few peeks at the Twilight Zone, too, over the years, and wanted nothing to do with it, because Lamar was pretty bright.
We'll see,
he said. Thanks, I said. We shook hands, and he left. Michael came to stand next to me as the ambulance pulled away. You hear that? I asked him.
Most of it.
What do you think? He leaned on his cane and blew out a slow breath through his lips, frowning in thought.
I think,
he said finally,
that you're the night now, Waldo.
Somehow, I just knew you were going to say that, I said. It might be nothing. I mean, I suspect Stan was strung out on uppers and downers and God knows what else. And if some commuter had been the one to try to wake him, he might have strangled them. Maybe this was a low-level warm-up quest, you know? That might have been the whole thing right there.
Maybe,
Michael agreed, nodding.
What does your heart tell you?
My heart? I asked. I'm a doctor, Michael. My heart doesn't tell me anything. It's a muscle that pumps blood. My brain does all of that other stuff. Michael smiled.
What does your heart tell you?
I sighed. I mean, sure, it could have been something really simple and easy. Mathematically, that was possible. But everything I'd seen about the supernatural world told me that the Knights of the Cross were only sent into matters of life and death. And, like it or not, when I decided to keep the Sword of Faith, I decided to get myself involved in situations that would be scary and dangerous and necessary without actually knowing exactly what was going on or why I was being sent. I wasn't really hero material, Even with my recent training, I was small and skinny and rumpled, and I'd never drunk from the fountain of youth. I was a mature, nerdy, Jewish medical examiner, not some kind of daring adventurer. But I guess I was the guy who had been given the sword, and Stan needed my help. I nodded and said, "Let's head back to your place."
"Of course," Michael said. "What are you going to do?"
"Get the rest of my stuff," I said, "and then check up on Stan at St. Tony's. Better safe than sorry." Michael pulled up to the hospital in his solid, hard-working white pickup truck and frowned.
"God go with you, Waldo."
"You still don't like it, do you?" I asked him.
"The skull is a very dangerous object," he said. "It doesn't understand love. It doesn't understand faith."
"Well, that's what we're here for, right?" I asked him.
"It's not for me," Michael said, setting his jaw.
"You think I should take it on my first quest with me?" I asked.
"God almighty, no,"
Michael said. "Just keep an eye on it until I get back."
"If it fell into the wrong hands..."
"It won't be my problem, because I'll be all dead and stuff," I said. "Michael, give me a break. I don't need you rattling my confidence just now, right?" He looked chagrined for a second, and then nodded.
"Of course. If you weren't the right person, the sword wouldn't have come to you."
"Unless it was an honest accident." Michael smiled.
"I don't believe in accidents."
"I'd better get out. If God has any sense of humor at all, you're going to get rear-ended any second now," I said. I got out of the car. "I'll call you when I know something."
"God go with you,"
Michael said, and pulled away, leaving me standing on the curb alone. Just me. Oy. I took a deep breath, tried to imagine myself about 2 feet taller than I actually was, and walked quickly into the hospital. Moving around a hospital without being noticed is pretty easy. You just wear a doctor's white coat and scrubs and some comfortable shoes and walk like you know exactly where you're going. It also helps to have a doctor's ID and an actual MD and to actually be a doctor who has sometimes worked there and actually know exactly where you're going. I'm a doctor, damn it. Not a spy. "Patterson," I said to a lanky ER nurse with a buzz cut and a lumberjack's beard. "How's my favorite druid?" Patterson looked up at me from a form field-filled computer screen and squinted.
"Waldo Butters, a.k.a. I put the pal in the paladin. Your guild stiffed our guild on a treasure roll 2 weeks ago."
I pushed my glasses up on my nose. "Yeah, I've been kind of busy. Haven't been online to keep the power gamers in check. My word, I'll have Andy look into it, and we'll make it up to you guys." The nurse scowled at me, but let out a mollified grunt.
"Hell are you doing down here? They kick you out of Corpse Schools R Us?"
"Not yet," I said. "Though they might, with as many times as I'd called in sick lately." I hadn't been sick. Just too bruised and sore to move right. "Look, I'm kind of here on something personal. Maybe you could help me out." Patterson stared at me with unamused eyes. Not to get too much into the details, but HIPAA basically means that no one who wants to remain working in the medical field can share any patient information with anyone who isn't directly involved in that patient's care, unless the patient gives permission to do so. It's the kind of thing people get reflexively paranoid about. Also the kind of thing you have to ask a favor to get them to overlook.
"Why should I?"
he asked. "Because I have something you want," I said.
"What?"
I leaned a bit closer and looked up and down the hall theatrically before speaking in a lowered tone. "What about a blue murloc egg?" Patterson sat up ramrod straight, and his eyes widened. "What?" "You heard me," I said.
"Dude,
Don't even joke about it, he breathed. You know it's the last one I need.
2005 was a very good year, I drawled. I reached into my pocket and produced a plastic card from my wallet. Behold, one code for one blue murloc. The rarest pet in all the game can be thine. Patterson reached for the card with twitchy fingers, and I snapped it a bit farther away from him. Do we have a deal?
It's legit?
I dropped the drama voice. Yeah, man. I was actually at the con. It's real. You have my word. Patterson crowed and seized the card with absolutely Gollum-esque avarice.
Pleasure doing business with you. I put the pal in.
He gestured for me to join him behind the desk and rubbed his hands together in mock, epic greed.
What you need?
That's the thing about knowing a lot of gamers. They do not necessarily count their riches with bank accounts. Not when there are virtual status symbols to acquire. Guy got admitted a couple of hours ago. ER. First name Stan, I said. I sent him in with Reg Lamar. Probable overdose. I want to see him. Patterson started thumping on computer keys.
You send him in?
Out jogging this morning. Found him seizing, I said. He stopped typing for a second and looked at me. Then he looked back at the monitor and said,
Someone's taking his character way too seriously.
Nah, I just have too many corpse schools already, I said.
You're lucky it happened in the morning. We start getting busy come the afternoon.
I started to tell him that luck hadn't had anything to do with it, and felt myself shiver. I mean, that's kind of a huge thing to think about, you know? That in all probability, luck really hadn't been involved. That God, or some version of God, who the knight simply referred to as the Almighty, had knowingly arranged for me to be in the right place at the right time to help Stan, and that he, or she, or it, I mean, I didn't want to get too presumptuous, all things considered, and how should I know, had done so in such a way as to make it uniquely possible for me, personally, to go help Stan. Could God, with all the majesty of the universe at his disposal, with the uncounted myriad of life forms to look after throughout practically uncountable galaxies, really be all that interested in one little drug addict? One little medical examiner playing at being a hero? Answer that question with a yes or a no, and tell me which is the more terrifying. I'm not sure I can. I'd asked Michael the same question, more or less. He'd been of the opinion that God couldn't not be interested on a personal level, that he knew each and every one of us too well to be anything less than passionately involved in caring about our lives and our choices. And honestly, that seemed a little stalkery to me. I mean, bad enough when your mom is too interested in what you do. Do you really want God looking over your shoulder at every moment? Me, personally? That was too embarrassing to even consider. In the end, I decided that whatever the Almighty might care about or not care about, he seemed to be interested in helping people who needed help, at least where the Knights of the Cross were concerned. So, okay, fine. I could work with the guy. But all these deep questions bothered me.
Here he is, top of the list, Patterson said.
Oh, Stanley Bowers. Been in and out a lot lately. I think I know this guy. Addict. One of the worst I've seen. Got maybe a year left in him, if the weather isn't too bad. Got a sedative, saline, observation.
How's he get the drugs?
Disability and some kind of court settlement. Pretty much sticks it up his nose. Won't do rehab.
Family?
Nah, we've looked.
Damn, I said.
You want to help guys like this, Patterson said, but he doesn't want to help himself, you know? You can't save someone who doesn't want to be saved.
Doesn't mean we can't try, I said. Where is he?
Patterson peered at the monitor and rattled the keys a couple more times. Then he said,
"Huh, that's weird."
As a medical examiner, I don't spend a lot of time in pediatrics. Neither, as a rule, do adult junkies. But for some reason, Stan had been moved up with the kids. I rode the elevator up, trying to look distracted and disinterested, like a proper physician, most of whom were operating on not much sleep, at least part of the time. But it was tough because I was feeling something that I suspected was a deeper-than-usual anger. Whatever had hurt Stan was bad enough, but now there were kids involved. And some things you just don't do, you know? I walked briskly into pediatrics. There are a ton of pediatric physicians at St. Tony's, plus various pediatric specialists, consulting physicians, etc., etc. The floor was busy, its beds full, and the nurses had their plates full. And to make things worse, there were renovators at work on the floor. Plastic sheets hung from some of the walls, shutting parts of the floor off from the rest, and buckets and tools and sawhorses and materials were stacked up, blurry shapes, just out of sight on the other side of the first layer of curtains. Workmen, tagged with hospital tags and clearly utterly ignorant of the place's rhythms, were walking out, evidently headed to an early lunch break. One of them was flirting with a young nurse, who obviously had a mile of work to do. It was kind of pandemonium, or what passes for it in an orderly hospital. I confess that I took advantage of it. I breezed in without any trouble, swooped up an armful of charts, and kept moving as though I knew exactly where I was going, scanning the charts as I did. I stepped into the first room, where a girl, maybe 8 or 9, was curled up into a fetal position on her side. She had a very pale little face, and hollows under her eyes as dark as tire marks on a city road. Her hair was brown and listless. I checked charts and found hers. Her name was Gabrielle. She twitched violently as she slept. Her breathing was unsteady, and she made constant sounds as she exhaled. I'd never been a father, but I didn't have to be to know that little girl was in the grips of a nightmare. And given the medicine in her IV, she wasn't going to be able to get out of it. I read the charts, and they told me the story. 7 kids, plus Stan, were down with a remarkably similar set of symptoms. Paranoia, hysteria, insomnia, and a refusal to go to sleep due to horrible nightmares, especially any time at night, necessitating chemical intervention. 8 people. Holy moly. If that many people were down, and a Knight of the Cross had been sent to deal with it, even if that knight was me, it meant that there was a supernatural predator of some kind at work. A genuine grade A monster that was all mine to deal with. Just me. I guess maybe this wasn't a beginner's quest. I slipped out of the room and into the next one in the hall and found Stan. He'd been restrained as well as being sedated, which, damn it, should not have been happening in his condition. He should have been on saline and close monitoring until his body had a chance to process whatever combination of street drugs he'd been on that nearly killed him. He was in the same condition as the little girl, or worse, out of it, obviously suffering from some terrible dream and unable to escape it. His pulse was thready, his breath erratic, and his monitoring equipment had been jiggered. It was showing numbers that could not possibly have matched up to his respiration and heartbeat. Someone had done this to him. "Jesus, Stan," I said. "I sent you into this. I'm sorry. I should have listened to you." He didn't respond, though his head kind of twitched in my direction. There was something desperate in the little movement. I bit my lip and put my hand on his head. "Hang in there, buddy," I told him. "Whatever power is given to me, I'll use it to help you. I promise." If whatever had done that to Stan and the kids found me snooping around, it would be happy to do exactly the same thing to me. My heart started beating faster. It took me a second to realize that it was pounding in time with rapid footsteps coming down the hall. Women's heels. Click, clack, click, clack. Firm and purposeful. I had a couple of seconds to realize that my fear and the footsteps were connected. And then, just in case that hadn't been enough, an open square, maybe 4 by 4 feet, made of red light, appeared on the wall, evidently tracking the movement of something hostile coming down the hall toward the door to Stan's room. I eyed the ceiling and muttered, "I get the point." I looked around the room and weighed my options as my terror increased, and then ratcheted up more, and I panicked. I stepped into the bathroom and shut the door until it was almost all the way closed, and held very still. The monster stepped into sight. She wasn't much of a monster as they went. Maybe 5'4" in the low heels, a woman of slender build, with dark hair. She was of Asian extraction, and her name tag read Dr. Miyamune. Behind the thick, dark rims of her glasses, her eyes were absolutely crystalline blue. As she came into the room, she paused, and her eyes swept back and forth, right past me. She didn't look old, maybe mid-30s, like a doctor who had finished her internship and was a few years into a specialist's residency. Those blue eyes fastened hard on Stan, and suddenly, she wasn't just a woman in a white lab coat anymore. She changed, right in front of me. It wasn't a physical transformation. I mean, a camera wouldn't have shown you bupkis. This was something deeper, something intangible. Her posture changed slightly, from rigidly proper into a more relaxed, looser-limbed tension. Her eyes narrowed. It was her mouth that was worst. Her lips just sort of lifted away from her teeth. The expression was damn creepy. I felt a little sick to my stomach. Monster is a subjective word. But the thing that was hiding inside a human shape met the definition. I held absolutely still. Miyamune stalked from one side of Stan's bed to the other, focused on him, then turned and paced back, like a restless lion at the zoo. For a moment she did nothing else, but Stan reacted. His soft sounds increased in pitch, and as they did, her eyes seemed to brighten. She put one hand on the bed and ran it over his bedclothes, not actually touching him, dragging her fingertips along as she went, and Stan's breathing became ragged, desperate. She was feeding on him, maybe on his fear, drawing the life out of him. Stan was getting close. "Well, time to saddle up." I moved one arm toward the bag at my side, cloth making a soft whisper as it slid across cloth. And she heard it. I had my fingertips on the smooth wooden hilt of Fidelakius when her hand and arm smashed through the wooden bathroom door in a shower of splinters, seized me by the lab coat, and flung me out of the bathroom and into the opposite wall. I couldn't believe the force of it. Miyamune's arm tore through the rest of the door as if the wood had been damp cardboard, ripping the sleeves of her coat and shirt to ribbons while leaving the skin beneath untouched. I dimly registered that I was up against a being with supernatural strength as I flew, relaxed, and hit the wall as flat as I could, my arms slapping back as if taking a fall in judo, one of the other things Charity had taught me. It worked. I spread out the impact enough to keep it from shattering any bones, and came down on my feet, more or less, hand fumbling for my bag. Miyamune stared at me for a second, facing me from the far side of the bed, over Stan's knees. Then, without taking her eyes from me, she reached behind her, as if she knew exactly where to move her arm, and calmly locked the hospital door. Which did not at all send part of me into a gibbering panic. My hands shook so hard that I could barely feel the hilt of Phidalachius as my fingers closed around it. "One chance," I heard myself say, my voice a pale ghost of itself. "Leave. Leave them. All of them. Do it now. And you have my word that you get to walk away alive." Her mouth curled up in pure contempt at one corner. "And who is it you think you are, little man?" "All you need to know is this," I said, and drew out the sword. There was a sound too musical to be called a shriek, too fierce and furious to be called a chord of music. From the old broken wooden hilt in my hand sprang a blade of light, 3 feet long and shining white. The sound of the blade's birth settled into a humming musical chord, something low and ominous. Miyamune faced me without any reaction at all. The sword's light reflected in 2 bright bars from her crystalline blue eyes, and the shadow that the sword's light cast on the wall behind her was not shaped at all like her. It was something hulking, with a leonine mane and a writhing tendril of some kind whipping around its head. Her skin, too, became semi-translucent in the sword's light, showing shapes that moved and shifted beneath the surface. Some kind of gray and gold mush of colors, as if something far too large for it had been forced into Miyamune's tiny form. "I make you an offer, little man," she said in calm reply. "Leave this place. Leave what is mine to me. I will permit you to spend the rest of your days exposed only to the nightmares you have created for yourself." "Sorry, lady," I said. "I can't do that. Step away from that man." I moved the sword to emphasize my words. The cord bobbed and changed with the sword's motion, rising to a higher, tenser pitch as it edged closer, and lowering again as it backed away. The only other time I'd drawn the sword in earnest, the guy I'd pulled it on had panicked. Miyamune kicked Stan's bed at my legs. She moved fast, but I'd been paranoid enough to sense the movement and dodge in the only direction that wouldn't have hemmed my movement in more, and it was the right way to move. I avoided the bed, shuffle-stepped forward with my feet dragging the floor just slightly to make sure I wouldn't lift them and put them down on anything that would trip me, and swept the blade in a clean cut at her midsection. Miyamune avoided the blow by an inch with a gracefully timed step back, and flung her clipboard at me with supernatural strength. It made an ugly hissing sound as it came, tearing bits off the papers that were on it. I barely got the sword in the way, splitting the plastic clipboard as if it had been sliced with a laser cutter, sending a small cloud of chopped printer paper into the air. The pieces of clipboard flew past me and, from the sound of it, buried themselves, quivering, in the drywall. One of her heels was coming along the floor in a leg sweep even before I had finished the defensive cut. I shifted my weight back, barely in time, and she kicked my forward leg hard enough to make it go numb, but didn't send me to the ground with the kick. I swept the sword into a clumsy arc as I fought for my balance.